true transformation comes by the work of God in a person's life. But what we can see, though, is that good, healthy leadership is humble. It's exemplary, meaning it sets examples, like we talked about earlier, like no job is too low. So therefore, the popularity of servant leadership. Now, the ironic thing about that is we can even then, if we're not careful, become very transactional in how we use leadership. And so I can even use servant leadership, quote unquote, to serve my sort of ends versus seeing serving as the end in and of itself. And so I think there's that idea of transactional versus transformational leadership. And so as a leader, I want to inspire change. I want to equip people. Good leaders, frankly, also are able to equip people. If you are not, and that's a core function of what pastors are called to do in the scriptures. It says that we are called to equip people to do ministry. And so if I'm not equipping anybody, I'm building it around potentially even myself, which is not a very good thing. And then I'm looking at a very egocentric ministry, which frankly, a lot of pastors can fall into, and it can get really ugly and destructive to a church, to a community, and ultimately to the pastor himself too. So there's a healthy, humble service mindset that seeks to help people get closer to God and also heal wounds in a community, to be agents of reconciliation and brokenness. And so if we can move the ball down the field, to borrow an American football analogy, by seeking to do those things, that to me is leadership. So you'd be able to help move people in that direction is huge, right? I hope that.
Yeah, that's useful. And I'm going to pick on one of those themes there, and it's the ability to be transformational or inspirational. So who's inspired your journey?
I've had, you know, frankly, most of the people in my life are coaches again, right? I've had my high school football coach, Coach Cray, I remember him. He taught me the principle of hard work, frankly. My college football coach taught me grit and determination, my offensive line coach that I experienced in college. I think about my dad, who taught me massively about integrity and being a man of integrity and a man of your word. I think about a couple of mentors that I had who were professors in college, and they taught me the beauty of integrating my faith into my life and to live an integrated life and to be able to be comfortable with the rawness and ugliness of life and not be afraid to wade into those hard places with people. So I think another realm of leadership is that it's willing to be honest about the state of life. And I think, frankly, if I'm really honest, I think culturally right now, I don't think we're a very resilient culture. And so what is called for is a resilient form of leadership as well. And so there's a dogged commitment to continue to pursue, because you've said you've made the commitment, you will see it through. Our head football coach in college, we would have to sign a year-long commitment letter that said, I will not quit this team. And it was a real binding letter that people took seriously, and we didn't take that flippantly. And I think there's so many times when you want to quit or give up, and you made good on your commitments because you said you would. And I think that's also important about leadership, that there's not perfection, but there's an integrity to how we conduct our lives and move forward.
As a Padre, picking up all those items that you've absorbed to become a leader in your own community, how do you walk the walk on that? Because that's a lot of things to be balancing, you're influencing, transforming, being determined, maintaining integrity, having an honest look at life. How do you balance all that, James? How do you walk the walk on that?
That's a good question, because pastors are not immune to moral failure. I just saw a week or two ago, another very prominent pastor, you know, fell into moral failure, and I think how do people fall into that trap? I think part of it is you get so caught up either what you're chasing. Here's the thing too. It's pastors. I'll let you in a little secret. Pastors can also not pursue God. Meaning we can use ministry or church or influence or whatever you want to call that and actually miss out on following Jesus as well, which is very interesting. And so what I mean by that is if you do not have people in your life where you can be completely honest and completely yourself, if there are places that are no-go zones in the corners of your heart or in the recesses of your mind, you need to be very careful and self-aware of those places. You also need, oftentimes leaders, I think this is generally speaking, put around them sometimes echo chambers that everybody thinks you're amazing. You walk on water, pun intended, right? You can do no wrong. And then what subtly begins to happen in a person's soul is you begin to believe the hype about yourself. And eventually, if that is left unchecked, you can go to some really dark places. And so for me, I have some great friendships, frankly. They say often too, and you can look at stats on this, that the pastoral role is one of the most lonely jobs on the planet. Part of that is because in the pastoral roles, they call it the pastor pedestal too. Like, oh, here's the holy man. Look at this guy. And that's why I'm like, I call myself again, more of a Jesus coach than a pastor, because I have people be like, oh, hello, pastor. And I'm like, oh, hello, little lamb. And then I pet them paternalistically in a joking manner on the top of their head, you know, because I want people to know, like, I'm not perfect either. And I think we need to be honest about our failures and our shortcomings and our mistakes. I think that we have to develop and cultivate healthy patterns. So for me, it's exercise. I exercise probably 5 to 6 days a week. That keeps my sanity, especially when I'm going on a bike ride. I love mountain biking and road biking. I like hiking. I try to stay fit, that way, because I think I take a holistic approach. So are you eating healthily? Are you sleeping well? Are you in good relationships with friends and people in your own family and in your community? Is your soul healthy? One of my mentors would often ask me the provocative question, how is your soul? And I'm like, that's a very awkward but very probing question that you feel like you can't hide behind. My hope is that I can say my soul is well or my soul is not well, and then share why I don't think I'm doing well today. I'll often do a mental check in my head. I don't know if you ever experienced that time where you feel like a bit of unsettledness or anxiety. If you don't know where it's kind of amorphous. You don't know exactly where it's coming from. Like, what am I feeling anxious about?
Yeah.
I'll sometimes find myself just having some time of self-reflection saying, that's where it is. That's what I feel uncomfortable about. And then hopefully having the courage to go visit that if it's important enough. To go visit what that issue is that's making me anxious, or say, put it in context, be like, this is kind of a silly thing. I don't need to try to solve every problem in the world today. Does that answer kind of your question? How do we stay healthy as leaders? How do we guard against epic failure and burnout and things like that?
Yeah, and it's really interesting because what you're indicating there is a very clear similarity between the role of your role as a spiritual leader and similar pressures and stresses that come to people in executive roles in other industries. But what I find quite interesting here is it, because you are of a spiritual educational background, you're open to discussing or open to the idea of having a soul and nourishing that soul as part of your own executive wellness package, if you like. So what's, and you've given us some very simple how-tos on that. Go and do some exercise. Have some good friends around you that you really, really trust for feedback, which is a similar theme that came out of one of my other shows recently, same thing. Trust the people who give you feedback.
You give me plenty of feedback, Ango. You don't hold back on me sometimes, but we're two brothers from other mothers anyway. But I also forgot to mention, I didn't mean to overlook this, but the spiritual disciplines of prayer, right? Of reading the scriptures, of solitude, of fasting, of of giving, of generosity. I mean, there's a lot of spiritual disciplines that have made people have healthy souls, right? And I didn't mean to overlook that earlier. That's the hardship of live, you know, discussion. But spiritual disciplines are also massive. And so if my faith is feeling rocky or I feel higher anxiety, oftentimes that's directly related to my lack or increase of prayer in my own life. And if I'm reading the scriptures to feed my soul, am I conscientiously caring for other people, or am I becoming more self-absorbed? So just want to give a shout out to the spiritual disciplines too.
Yeah, that's really good, because what you're speaking to there in my mind is this notion that people in executive roles need to give over 5 hours a week to intentional learning. So you're doing that as a spiritual discipline. Not only are you recognizing your own competencies through your own subject matter, but you're also walking the walk in you don't indoctrinate yourself, because you're open to learning, and you're doing that through a spiritual discipline. And what I'm intrigued by here is, you know, you're a man of younger years, burdened with wisdom. And yet you're taking on a load from your community. You've mentioned already today about substance abuse, moral failure, and, you know, equal and similar pressure loads. Where do you learn? Where do you get your learning from? So we just spoke about, you know, managing the stresses, but who teaches the padre?
Well, it's funny you ask that, Ango, because there was a famous Londoner preacher by the name of Charles Spurgeon. Maybe you've heard of him. I don't know.
I can't indulge you with my own ignorance, James. It's not the purpose of this broadcast.
I think it was him. It was him or another guy by the name of D.L. Moody who said, I read the Bible in one hand and I have the newspaper in my other hand. And so I what I like about that is he was able to put into context life and the scriptures, right? And so what I try to do is, for example, we've just gone through election season, still going through all of these things. So I have right now in my office probably about 5 to 6 books on political theory and the nature of faith and politics, as that's a very rabid and crazy environment, especially as it comes to American evangelicals and engaging in politics. And so I've been trying to formulate my own thinking about that. And what do the scriptures have to say about that? And so that forms my preaching. Is that's kind of, again, you want to talk about a quote unquote platform. I mean, weekly giving a sermon is the place where you want the Bible and life to come together and connect. And so I like reading about current events. I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. So I try to read pretty fairly and regularly that newspaper. I think it's also though important that we keep engaged and keep in contact with people who don't think or believe or look or talk like we do. I try to avoid echo chambers. And so it's really important for me to go and talk to people and have coffee or empanadas or fish and chips, as we've done before, but with people who are not necessarily Christian, or maybe have different views on things. And so I try to keep fresh on thoughts that are out there, things that are forming not just culture, but frankly, again, as a pastor, our people are frankly more formed by the culture sometimes than they are by Jesus too. And so I ask the question, who is discipling you, right? We're all disciples or apprentices of someone or something. And so I try to read, I read the Bible. Right now I'm going through the book of Proverbs and the book of 2 Kings. But I also want to read stuff that forms my preaching, and also forms me as a leader too. So I'll read stuff, a great book by Edwin Friedman called A Failure of Nerve. I think I gave you a copy of that. And the subtitle of that is Leadership in the Age of the Quick Fix. So I do a lot of thinking about what does leadership look like? What does community look like in these times? How do we think about these important things that are on everybody's mind? And so you want to speak to those.
You know, and that intrigues me, James. And there's a reason for why. I was just listening to you speak there. And I've worked in service sector industry, but you are in the extreme end of the service sector industry. You've got to be live and alive for any personality who comes through your door at any day, any time. That really is, you're an extension beyond service. You're into extreme service.
Being in a voluntary organization, you don't get to choose necessarily who walks through your doors, right?
Right. No. Yeah, 100%. So how do you, in a non-traditional, a non-traditional business or a traditional industry in a non-traditional business performance environment, how do you measure success on a weekly or monthly or quarterly basis?
Ango, if they would give that. All right. So if they could do this metrics, how do you measure success in particularly ministry? How do you measure in some ways the immeasurable? How do you measure what's going on in a person's heart? How do you measure transformation? So you begin to see it. Well, the Bible says there's the fruit of the Spirit, right? Love, joy, peace, patience, yep. Goodness, yep. Kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. So if we can start to see these things manifesting themselves, they're fruit, right? We should be able to see them. I'd say, hey, we're winning. We're moving the ball down the field. I think when we can say and see that, for example, marriages, right? Sometimes we're marriage counselors. If we can say, hey, that marriage was on the brink of divorce and they've been able to reconcile and get healthier and better as a couple, that's a way we can see that. I've seen it in two stories in particular through COVID of people dealing with their alcoholism. And I just got a text from a gal just yesterday, I believe she celebrated her 200th day of sobriety. I'm like, that's a win. And she was thankful that we did not just cast her out as a church. Like, we showed her grace. We hung in there with her and we're walking the path of sobriety with her, not necessarily deeply, deeply fully engaged, but like we're there encouraging her. You know what I mean? And so when we see that people are becoming less consumed with themselves, if they're moving to generosity rather than selfishness, if they're becoming more prayerful, if they're engaging in broader community and they're not retreating, frankly, one of the signs to me of spiritual illness is if you are retreating into yourself, that is not a good sign. And if you're engaging more broadly with the community, and frankly, it's when people finally get honest. I often have people say, honestly, and I go, no, lie to me right now, lighten the load a bit, right? Like, to de-escalate the craziness of the situation, because now finally we're dealing in real. And so some of the metrics of success are that when we see kids getting help because our church is next to a public school, when we see these kids who are literally like one step from homelessness getting either safer in the homes or structured lives better, so they're succeeding better in school. Like, there's ways that we can see some of these things, but oftentimes I think we'll be shocked that we'll look back and say, man, God, I don't, what have we succeeded in? I don't know. And sometimes it's really hard to measure, you know, because numbers are one indicator, but they are not necessarily a sign of success. So the biggest mega church of thousands, 5,000, 10,000 people may not be as effective as a church of 50, frankly.
And that comes back to your point about traditionally church being the heart of the community with commonality with folks. And to my mind, a mega church is a representation of a commercial corporate profit making approach, as opposed to what you've just described, which is a spiritual approach, which is what we want our churches to invest in, is our spirituality, if particularly as you say about moral failure, and we can't do that ourselves.
No, this is not American individualism. Is really, in a sense, idolatrous, right? I mean, is not the essence of sin, when you read in the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit, is us, humanity, declaring our independence from God. And so what we see then is, as a result of that, our relationship with God is frayed, our relationship with one another is frayed, our relationship with creation itself is frayed. I mean, look at the issues we've seen in Colorado this summer with the fires, right? We see the brokenness of the world. We see the hurricanes. We see the floods. We see the earthquakes. We see the brokenness of the natural world. And then ultimately, we even see it with ourselves. We see that, frankly, as G.K. Chesterton said, there was a newspaper headline, British writer, right? And they said, "What's wrong with the world?" And they said, legendarily, I don't know if it was apocryphal or not, or a true story, but he wrote back to this newspaper asking the question, "What's wrong with the world?" And he said, "Dear sirs, you asked what's wrong with the world, and I wanted to let you know I am." It's yours truly, G.K. Chesterton. Right? And so we even see the breakdown within ourselves. And so we want to be agents of reconciliation, as the scriptures say, with God, reconciling people with God and reconciling people with each other. And so I think the church is positioned well to deal with the issues of race, right, that are going on crazily in our society right now. They're dealing on the breakdown, a political breakdown. So, again, we have the ability to reconcile people from radically different sides of the aisle, right, or sides of the spectrum. And so we want to be agents of God's grace and healing in communities and providing hope. And, again, as we talked about how COVID, it's exposed our fear of death and saying, hey, we even have good news that we believe Jesus resurrected and defeated even death itself, right? So there you go.
So let's come back a couple of steps there, because using the Christian Old Testament story of Adam and Eve and pulling the apple from the tree is sort of a sign of broken morality, if you like, or independence from God. And that's a really nice philosophical approach to what we're talking about right now. So as a CEO or as an executive of the church, or a CEO of religion, if you like, and I say that tongue in cheek, but those folks who are in executive leadership are problem solvers. You have to solve problems if you want your business or your organization or your product to flourish. So we can't stick the apple back on the tree. We can't put a Band-Aid on it or a bit of masking tape. And if we do, it's going to look weird. So the apple's been well and truly plucked. So how do we go about fixing ourselves spiritually?
Or the other adage of, you can't unscramble those eggs, right? Or the cow has left the barn, if you will, as another farm analogy. We talked a little bit about this earlier. It's like, we need to be honest with ourselves. And I think humility is being honest with who you really are. It's properly thinking, it's rightly thinking of yourself. Another good book for leaders out there is called Leadership and Self-Deception. The scary thing is, if we live in self-deception, we don't know we've actually deceived ourselves. And that's a very scary place to be. And so in the good book, it says, if we claim to be without sin, right, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. And so we need to be honest about our own failures and shortcomings, which then allow us to be humble. If we are honest about that, then we can be humble with ourselves and honest with ourselves and others about who we are. And then they say, I think one of the lines they say is, vulnerability is one of the most universally understood things. Like, people long for people to be authentic. We even use that language in pop culture, right? Authenticity wins the day. Well, Authenticity means you're honest about the ugly bits too, and your failures, and you don't have to live in pretense any longer. And so when you're leading an organization, again, talking with a friend today at lunch about this, trust is the foundation of pretty much everything, right? And so do we even trust the media, right? Do we trust our political leaders? Do we trust our spiritual leaders? Do we trust our own spouses or friends? When trust is broken, it's really hard to have any relationship. And so Patrick Lencioni, in his book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, he talks about the pyramid, and it's ultimately based on trust. And so that goes back to truth, truthfulness, and reality as well. And so to be fully connected with that. And so a healthy leader will be honest, first and foremost, about themselves. It means, too, that we're not going to tell ourselves lies about where our organization is. If we want to talk about organizational leadership, I know pastors that flub their numbers all the time to make their church sound bigger and better than it really is, right? Or we tell lies about ourselves to make ourselves look better than we really are. And we pretense. And now we can't deal with anything real. And so I think the core foundation of this is to be honest about who we are, about this nature of our organizations. And then we can start to work with that. Does that make sense? I don't know if I answered the question.
Again, you are a great debater around a lot of areas here, and you're very well versed in your area of expertise. And as we are recording this on Armistice Day, Veterans Day, however you want to label that, I want to ask a question. I was looking at a picture, it was a picture from the UK that was talking about, you know, as a picture of Sikh and Muslim and Hindu fighter pilots who fought in the Battle of Britain. You know, not one of them's white because they come from other parts of the Commonwealth. I have this, and I know we're sort of straying off the subject. Well, I don't think it is straying off the subject of leadership, but there's an essence there of real leadership where if you look at, as you were saying earlier, the politicization of everything we do, particularly in the last 30 to 60 days with the presidential election. Does humanity come out of struggle? Because we were very accepting of having Hindu, Sikh, Muslim fighter pilots fight the battle of the skies or fight for control of the skies back in a world war. But if we go back to the UK today, and you and I were respecters of all spiritualities, and we're respecters of community, and we're respecters of people who've made a sacrifice. But when I look at things like Brexit, it sort of breaks my heart, where Brexit is about, became a vote on immigration, not on economic policy. And yet there's those people in that photo who made sacrifices for a common good, beyond spirituality, which is what service is about. So I suppose the question I'm asking is, mainly because you've also brought this up about, we may be spiritual in our leadership, but we are also human. So how is it in a situation like that, where the world is on fire, and Sikh, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian can all come together under the same umbrella to oppose, let's say, evil? And yet today, in a world where we have everything at our fingertips, internet speed, food on order, sunny days, cars to drive, and money to burn, we seem to be losing sight of that kind of humanity.
Well, I think you raise up a couple of good points, and maybe one of those things I was also thinking about in relation to that, what do we do with our problems? And what you're describing there, I think universally everybody can say this world is messed up. I think everybody would be lying to themselves if we said this world is fine, it's getting better, utopia is just around the corner. And that was partially the problem of modernism, that we thought progress was inevitable. And eventually we would achieve this. And I think you talk about world wars, the Cold War, current conflicts around the world, racial tensions, economic tensions, all those things. if we're proven again and to say like, wow, this world is not as we hoped it would be. And I think part of the way that we move forward is also deeply rooted in the gift of what is known as grace and forgiveness. I mean, that is at the heart of the Christian message distinctly, right? That grace is an unearned favor and a willingness to overlook wrongs. Forgiveness, I would argue, is the way forward. If we want to continue to exact revenge, I often think about the conflict in the Middle East with the Israelis and the Palestinians. Until forgiveness is extended, you're left with vengeance and retribution. Or you look at places like South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that finally they dealt honestly about the evils that were perpetrated against racial minorities. And they sought to bring about reconciliation. They even put that in there. Desmond Tutu, right? Archbishop Tutu helped lead some of those things. You look at Rwanda and the Rwandan genocide in 94. And there were cultural practices of forgiveness and restoration to be able to move forward. So I'd say, and we talked about it this summer too, in the racial tensions here in the States, the way forward is the gospel, the good news of grace and forgiveness. And it does not then lock us into a sense of vengeance, even though we feel this anger, and that in some ways that anger is good and right when injustice happens, and we should be angry about injustice. But we recognize in the Christian tradition, as the good book says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And so therefore we can be agents of peace and reconciliation and don't have to take matters into our own hands. And out of that too, I think Christians, Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, where we can find common ground, we should seek for the common good. And it doesn't mean that we change our beliefs or change our convictions about God or the world and things, but there are probably more things that we would find that we can find common ground in to work for the common good that we could agree upon. And so we can work together to move forward in some of those areas. And I think that's important as well as leaders now, because frankly, it feels sort of like we're descending more into tribalism where it's all or nothing, right? It's a zero sum. Winner or loser, that's it, right? Yeah. And then in that sense, everybody loses.
So, and I'm glad you raised that, because if I look at the UK, so you've got the Church of Scotland, the Church of England, the Catholic Church, the Jewish faith, you've got the Islamic faith. They tend to, in general terms, coexist quite well. The Jewish faith has the chief rabbi. Church of England still has the Archbishop of Canterbury.
The chief rabbi, by the way, Lord Jonathan Sacks, passed away of cancer last week, sadly. He was a brilliant man, wrote some great books. One of his great lines, Jonathan Sacks, Lord Sacks, said, "Faith is the courage to live with uncertainty." I thought that was a great line.
So, and I'm sort of floating this question off the back of a half-formed thought. So France is a Catholic country that struggled with the Islamic faith, but they brought the Islamic faith into the country subsequent to the Algerian War. The UK was a Christian and still is ideologically a Christian country, but has accepted, you know, Catholicism and Judaism and Islam, Sikhism, yeah. Hinduism. Not everyone likes it, but we don't see that volatility there. And yet when we look at, let's say, China, irreligious, communism is their ideology. The US perpetuates a stance of Christianity. And then we have places like Iran that's a theocracy. I'm going to switch this around on you. Sorry to do this to you, James. If you were the head of spirituality for the US, is the answer in monotheistic cultures I don't know, is it pluralism? Is that the alternative?
Well, I think you just touched on it. How do we live in a pluralist society? And that's the tension that's going on in the American church right now, as it increasingly feels like Christendom, again, we talked about this earlier, kind of coming full circle, as Christendom is on the wane and whatever ism is on the rise, and it's hard to actually define where it goes from here. Maybe again, if we're left without virtue, all you have left is power, which is interesting to me as well. And so I think we're seeing a virtue decrease in our culture. And you are seeing the increase in power plays, right? And so it just comes down to raw exertion of power and winners and losers, like we talked about. Leslie Newbegin, another famous British missionary, as they would say, like Dr. Livingstone. Missionary. He went to South India and he left England. And when he came back, I believe 40 years later, he was shocked at how post-Christian Britain had become culturally. Meaning he left where it felt like the church in England was thriving. He goes to India, the center of Hinduism, right, to India, comes back and shocked, like, what happened to Christianity in the UK? And he actually wrote a book called The Gospel in a Pluralist Society. And he's saying, how do you retain your distinctions? And I don't have a lot of Jewish friends that are rabbis or things like that, but I think back about, how has Judaism survived so long? You think about all that the people of Israel, right? The ancient Hebrews, right? How have they survived? And I think, and be happy to be proven wrong, is that they retained their distinctions even if they were a radical minority. You look at church history.
So they're like the New York Yankees, aren't they? Everyone loves to hate them.
They continue on. It's amazing. You look at a church, again, the monastic communities that survived and thrived, frankly, and grew. You look at St. Patrick and his movement to those little Irish people, you know, in Ireland. What happens there is, frankly, that religious ministering or working from the margins of society can actually be really effective because it forces you to say, this is what we believe, this is what we are committed to, and we will not change, even if the world's changing around us. And they, at the same time, they were able to adapt to the culture that was around them as well. One of my friends has a great line. He says, we want to be solid at the core and fluid at the edges. I think that's great. Meaning we can retain our distinctives, but we can adapt to the cultural situations in which we find ourselves.
Be like bamboo.
Bamboo just keeps growing, right?
Well, it's solid at the core, but can bend in the wind.
Yeah, and it's really, really solid. And so I think we don't know if we want to go down this bunny trail of tolerance, but tolerance is not the mere acceptance of everything is fine and hunky-dory and don't tell me that's wrong. Tolerance is the ability to live with others, even with differences, and not seek to smite or destroy them. And so I think a healthy recovery of what true tolerance is helpful, again, because it doesn't mean that you are giving up your belief or you even actually necessarily change your belief, but that you are willing to live with deep differences and not hate or despise your neighbor, frankly. And so this is what is going to be a challenge for people of faith, particularly in America, is how do we, as an increasing minority culture, aka Christianity in America, how does it live and thrive from the margins? I think about that stuff often.
James, I think what you've just done there is underpin the importance of spiritual leadership through the explanation of tolerance. We as humans in our own failures need, I hesitate to use the word, but professional spiritual leadership from people like yourself to enable us to maintain the, you know, keep the glue in our gravy and keep the fabric of our community all stuck together. Otherwise, without that kind of guidance, we're all going to fall down and start hitting each other with sticks.
Well, again, you got to talk about tribalism, but Jesus said, you are, talking to his disciples, he said, you are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world. Those aren't statements of pride or arrogance, but what he's saying is you have a distinctive, you have an obligation. salt was a preservative, right? In a sense, it preserved meat from rotting. It added flavor to whatever you were tasting, and light in the darkness. I mean, when, let's be honest, it feels like we're entering into a dark time. It really does. And so the distinctives and opportunities that, you know, me again, as a Christian pastor, that we have to retain a distinctive as a culture that is heavenly minded, but seeking the good of the earth as well. Right. Meaning, yeah. We want to be fully engaged with this world, but we don't look like the world. Right. We don't mimic the ways of the world. And at the same time, we look to a higher authority, a higher kingdom, a better kingdom than the kingdoms of this world. And we want to be, as the word is, an ambassador, right? An emissary, representing a better way and a better kingdom and a way of hope and joy and peace. And ultimately, as Jesus says, even eternal life, which is good news.
There's so many pathways I want to go down with this conversation and
podcasting together. You know, we've always talked about Peacock and Padre podcasting. So maybe this is just part.
Maybe we do need to, because I think, and one of the reasons I asked you to come on the show, like all the people I asked to come on the show, is because you're very real and you are very authentic, and you are, to my mind, a true flag waver for your brand and your brand values in your professional or in your vocational arena. However, we are going to have to come to a gradual close here.
And a gradual? We've got two more hours of this.
Well, those other subjects for another time. So here's how we generally close the show. So first I'm going to play back to you some of the things I've heard in the conversation. So in your James the Padre layer cake of leadership, we have influence, engagement, transformational, not transactional. We have determination, industry, integrity, honesty, and discipline. There's more in there. So we've flushed out a lot, and this is like a big old Yorkshire fruitcake of leadership loveliness. And what I'd like you to do with your own words, these are your own words, and this is your recipe for leadership. Who do you see out there in the world today that is an embodiment of these characteristics and attributes?
Who do I see today as an embodiment? Well, I will say again, I look at my dad. I really love my dad, proud of my dad and how he's lived his life as a good old farm boy from Nebraska himself and just retired. This past year, I'll be honest. Yeah, I thought about this question a little bit. I should have probably thought a bit more about it, but I don't necessarily have a lot of modern living people that I look to necessarily. I think there are some glaring voids. I look at my own mentors though. So I think of my mentor, Lyle Dorsett, or I think of my mentor, Eric Swanson, who would be a great guy to have on the podcast sometime. Get Eric on. I look at my mentor, one of my mentors out here, another one who would be great is a guy by the name of Tom Melton. And so there are guys in my life that I know personally who have really helped form me, shape me, coach me spiritually and on leadership that I think have been massive. But then a lot of guys are not necessarily even around anymore. A guy that's hugely influential and just really inspired me was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was the German pastor who was a part of the assassination attempt against Hitler, part of Operation Valkyrie. And C.S. Lewis forms a lot of my thinking and my imagination. I think as leaders, we need to be creative, and you need leaders who inspire imagination and creativity into your thinking processes. I think there was a Catholic priest by the name of Henry Nouwen who wrote truly the best book on leadership I've ever read, called In the Name of Jesus, Reflections on Christian Leadership. And so some of these guys are dead. Eugene Peterson was another great guy, who great writer and a great pastor to people. And so I look to those guys who are humble. Another modern one who's popular is a guy by the name of Tim Keller. He actually helped start a church in Manhattan. Start from scratch a church in central Manhattan. That's pretty hardcore right there. And to build a thriving church in the middle of Manhattan in pretty secular New York City is no small feat. And so, but I try to avoid pop leaders because I feel like they're not going to last, right? Pop stuff fades and it's forgotten about until the new fad comes in. And so I think it's finding deep rooted, often dead people who can inspire you and have thought more deeply and a lot more concretely and clearly than often what we see in our modern pictures of leadership.
Yeah, I was just thinking that's, and I was running back through my previous few shows and the guests I've had on, and very few of them are pulling public figures out. And I always had an expectation when I set this show up that people would be pulling down on public figures as inspiration, but it seems to be very personal, which comes back to your point earlier. It feels like we're entering a dark phase in the universe, if you like. And so the next question I have for you is, music and reading are real balances for me. They have been constants in my journey. I love reading and I love music. They both are tools that help me maintain equilibrium. What would be the one book or the one piece of music that you would keep with you on your journey to maintain equilibrium?
Well, the Bible, but that probably doesn't count because that's already known.
That was a given. That was a given.
That's like saying, who's your favorite person in the Bible? Well, Jesus, that doesn't count. Come on.
Oh, Jesus. Is that a pun?
Yeah. You want it relating to leadership?
I want it relating to James Hoxworth.
One book that I would keep with me.
One book or one piece of music that is the thing that always you come back to for equilibrium.
So truly, I probably read In the Name of Jesus maybe once a year, maybe every other year. It's a short little book. It can be almost read in one sitting.
Yeah.
Or Bonhoeffer's Life Together. That's another. Those are two books that I often come back to refocus on why we do what we do. Bonhoeffer's book, Life Together, was written to these German pastors who were trying to remain faithful and minister in the midst of the rise of Nazism. So imagine the historical context of that.
Yeah.
Here's how we're going to keep faithful, friends. Here's how we're going to be faithful to God and how we're going to serve people as Hitler's going across Europe. Crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
And in the name of Jesus, Henry Nouwen was this Catholic priest who taught at Harvard and left like the most elite of teaching posts, right, in America, and goes and lives amongst an adult disabled community of mentally disabled adults. And he went and just served there in obscurity, right? And so he rejected, in a sense, fame, and he just served. And those two remind me, those anchor me pretty well as a leader. And music-wise, man, a few years ago, Yo-Yo Ma, I love cello music. Yo-Yo Ma was at Red Rocks out here in Colorado, Red Rocks Amphitheater. And he did all of Bach's 6 cello suites from memory. It was insane. It was Yo-Yo Ma by himself on the stage in Red Rocks Amphitheater, which holds about 10,000 people, not a music stand in sight, but 4 ground-based microphones to pick up his cello, a chair, and a bottle of water. And he played for almost 2.5 hours from memory Bach's cello suites. Cello, they say, is actually the instrument that most resonates with the human voice. It's actually the most closely related to the human voice, the sound of the cello, which I don't know why it's so warm. I love cello music. And so often I'll just play on my Amazon Music or on Pandora or Spotify or whatever, just like some cello music. And I'm getting into lo-fi too. Lo-fi is kind of cool. It's got that cool beat. It's easy to read too. And good jam.
I'm going to go and listen to that after this show. So last question we have, with your high standards of leadership that you've set for yourself on this journey, what's the one luxury you're going to carry with you on your leadership journey that's going to guarantee you continue walking the walk?
Well, I'll probably fail you on that. Like, let me say a couple of quick things. One, I think exercise, and with exercise, I feel like that's an act of worship as well, because I actually can pray sometimes. I'll think through stuff. It's a great way to burn off stress. So exercise is one thing, and that's through a variety of things. The other luxury that I'll afford myself is I will probably 2 to 3 times a year go away to the mountains, ideally to my buddy's place in Telluride, where you have also been. And so I go away there to do some study, prep, thinking, journaling sometimes, just practicing the spiritual disciplines, to go away and just kind of map it out, which I would recommend any leader should just have some time. Call it a study leave. I don't know, use 3 to 4 days of just somewhat unplugging, but getting away to map out where you want to go in the next year, in the next few months. So that's a big luxury to me that I really, really take seriously. So
James, that's the end there. And I really appreciate you. And I appreciate you coming on here on this day of global spirituality and remembrance. And, you know, thank you very much for talking so openly on a subject that can cause a lot of people many problems, particularly in the world we live in. So thank you very much. And it was great to have you here.
Well, I'm honored in the proper sense. H-O-N-O-U-R-E-D, I believe. I'm honored. And I love you, my friend. And I look forward to keeping our conversations going. So thank you. And I hope it made sense.